Welcome to the Donna Sebo Show. Donna is an international mental practitioner, award-winning author, counselor, speaker, teacher, and radio TV personality. Dedicated to empowering others through her mental skills, she also features authors and experts from all over the world to share their knowledge and experience with you, the listening audience. Now, let's join Donna and her guests. Here's Donna.
Hello, and welcome to an hour of mind power. This is Donna Sebo, and today we're going to be taking a journey that will have a fictitious costuming to it, but it is based on fact. The journey is going to be with Kent Nerburn and his wonderful book, The Wolf at Twilight. This is about an Indian elder's journey through a land of ghosts and shadows. Kent, I want to welcome you to the show.
Well, I'm happy to be here.
I was really intrigued by your material. I don't often have guests on that deal in a fictitious format, but I was so intrigued with your material and the way you presented it and how well done it was relative to Native American culture.
Well,
now, you're widely recognized as one of the few people in this country who can be comfortable bridging the gap between what would be described as white man's thinking and red man's thinking, and I'm not saying that to be in a negative at all.
Mm-hmm.
You use Native and non-Native cultures. You have a gift of storytelling that I think is phenomenal. You live in Minnesota. And I love the fact that you are involved with animals, that you have an irascible orange cat you call Sid.
Sadly, Sid has gone to his greater reward, or as the Native people would say, he's walked on.
He has walked on. Well, it's always, you know, they come into our lives and bring such wonderful gifts. But this is based on a real experience.
Yes.
So let me ask you a question. Why did you decide to put your experience within a fictitious format?
Well, the whole fiction, nonfiction distinction is artificial in relation to Native storytelling. The Native people, an easier way to think about it is the way that, say, the Buddha stories are told or the Gospels are told, that they seek truth, not factual accuracy. The parables and the Gospels are the same sort of stories.
Mm-hmm.
What I wanted to do here is I worked with Native people for many years. I lived between three reservations in northern Minnesota, and I've had the good fortune to know Native people, to work with them, and one of the elders said to me, people learn by stories.
Mm-hmm.
You need to teach by stories because stories lodge deep in the heart. And Dan, the man with whom I travel, was not someone who wanted himself to be known or seen as an authority or a spokesperson for all Native people. So he said, we have to hide me. We hide me as if I'm being hunted.
Mm-hmm.
So what we really did is we crafted a story that touched the truths that he believed were important while keeping him hidden so people couldn't go out and find him. So it's a very odd amalgam. The last thing I would say to that is asking whether it's true or false is like asking whether Van Gogh's paintings are true or false. It's
mm-hmm.
kind of an irrelevant question when you're dealing with spiritual documents and with Native people.
I agree with you, but I wanted you to make the statement. Now, you have written other things in the past, but Dan is a man that you actually knew. Now, he's in his 90s, and the way the story begins is that he lets you know in his own unique way that you've got a job to do.
Right.
And tell us how you got to know Dan and why it was he wanted you to tell his story.
We have to go way back to the late 90s when I was doing an oral history project on the Red Lake Reservation, collecting the memories of the tribal elders with a group of students. At the completion of that project, we turned out a book called To Walk the Red Road that was done only within the school district, but it was photographs and memories of the elders. It became very well known throughout Indian country. It would travel on the powwow circuit, and people would get a hold of it. Dan, out in the Dakotas, was one of the people who got a hold of this book. He had his granddaughter contact me, and I got a call basically saying, my grandfather wants to talk to you. And I said, well, is he angry? And he said, no, he just wants to talk to you. So I went out and sat down with him, and it turned out what he wanted to do was tell me his thoughts about life and tell me the stories that he had heard and tell me the way it was that he looked at the world around him. And he sort of picked me out because he trusted what I'd done in the oral history books. So that the book that resulted from that journey with Dan was called Neither Wolf Nor Dog. And that book was published in the mid-90s and became the Minnesota Book Award winner and has been used all over the world in indigenous cultures and has been taught in colleges and reservations. And I was very pleased with the book, but never thought I would do anything else because there was that whole issue of fiction and nonfiction. Also, I didn't want to be seen as exploiting Native people. And so I'd let the issue just settle. I'd let the book Neither Wolf Nor Dog speak for itself. Well, Dan died in 2002, and I thought I would do nothing more. Well, the book was our testament to our friendship and what he knew. But I had always, since dealing with the elders on the Red Lake Reservation, been haunted by the look in their eyes when they started talking about the boarding schools. And one day, not too many years ago, I was traveling through North Dakota on the way down to South Dakota to the Standing Rock Reservation and stopped at a little cafe. It was just a little cement block cafe. There was an old Indian man sitting in there, and I just asked if I could sit with him. And we got talking about the boarding schools. And the boarding schools, we can talk about in a bit, were a horrible experience for the people.
Mm-hmm.
And he said to me, I asked him if he went to the boarding schools. He said, oh, yeah, I went to the boarding schools. I learned English. I learned good Christian, but I'm no longer myself. I'm somebody else. And that just struck me in the heart, and it made me remember all that sadness in the eyes of the elders. And I thought, well, Dan had been in the boarding schools. Maybe it's time for me to tell the rest of Dan's story and bring the story of the boarding schools to the fore. So that was what I did when I sat down to write The Wolf at Twilight. I said I wanted to tell, there was still more of Dan's teachings that I wanted to give, but I also wanted to tell some of the heartbreak that the Native people had experienced as embodied in his struggles with the loss of his little sister in the boarding schools. So it was really a book that came about because of kind of a promise I'd made to always try to be a voice for Native people and Native thinking if they wanted me to do so.
I have to chuckle because in your book, in the beginning, as you're setting up the whole persona of what is going to be shown through the storytelling, you have a meeting with Dan, and he compliments you because you're not filling up every silence with words, and he knocks you in the shin with an old willow cane. He says, you're going Indian on him. And you say, no, I'm just getting older and wiser. And he whacks you again, saying, getting old don't make you wise.
That's right.
You have such a wonderful way of painting emotions and pictures that you feel like you're right there. So I could just see him being, using the words you used with your cat, irascible old man, right there, just
right.
Being
mm-hmm.
totally sassy. And that's what the grace of age gives you, is the right to be that way. You brought up the boarding school.
Mm-hmm.
There is so much in history that is recorded by historians, and it is easy to take a mental eraser and ignore so many of the different experiences and so much of the Native American experience in the tremendously fast shift in their lives. I mean, it was just, when you think about it, it was a very short period.
Right.
And their whole cultural aspect, everything was thrown to the winds, you might say. And the children were so affected, and so many of them were kidnapped, really, and
right.
put into environments like you said, of the boarding school, and this, when you read it, you think, gee whiz, are you sure? This sounds like something out of Charles Dickens.
Well, in many, you know, in many ways, there's an irony in that it is like something out of Charles Dickens. For those who don't know, the boarding schools were really, there was a good intention behind them. If we sort of look at the way that the mental set of people was in the late 1800s, there was a belief in evolution of the evolution of the human species was to go from paganism and savagery up through agrarianism and Christianity. And the people dealing with the Native Americans looked at them and said they might be good people, but they are doomed because they are not evolving. The way to make them evolve is to turn them into, essentially turn them into Europeans. And so the motto of the man who started the boarding schools was kill the Indian to save the man. Well, sometimes he killed the Indian as well. Mm-hmm. So they set up these schools that were residential schools where the kids were brought. And they were brought into these schools, taken away from their families, brought into the schools, made to, they could not speak their own language, they had their hair cut. I remember one tremendously sad story of a woman who had, her mother knew she was going to boarding school and wanted to send her off, like any mother sending her child off to school, made her a dress. She spent all winter sewing her a dress out of, you know, that old blue and white material that you make, that in mattresses are made from, old mattresses. They cut up their mattresses. She took that material, made her a dress, covered it with beads, sent her off to the boarding school, hoping that she would learn something of contemporary or of modern European culture so she could have a better life. And the second she got there, the people, the matrons said, take off your dress. And they made her throw it in a fire and watch it burn because they said, we don't want you wearing this pagan clothing. And these children were made to look upon their parents as evil, as people who were, not possessed of the devil, but who were essentially that they were evil, that they did not have the truth. And you can imagine what that's like when you're taken away from your family and you're indoctrinated into being someone who is told that your parents are evil, their way of life is evil, and you'll be going to hell if you follow their way of life. And this is what these little kids went through. And then when they ended up going back to their families, very often they couldn't fit in. They didn't know what to think of their own parents. They were lost souls, and they passed this down. As Dan, the protagonist of the book, says, the effect has been felt downstream, that so many of them, the children, when they grew up, didn't know how to be parents because they hadn't had parents. They'd been put in boarding schools. They'd been dealt with corporal punishment. So they started to, they thought that was how you raise children. So they started beating their own children. And we see the effects of this on the reservation today. And then this doesn't even begin to address the terrible things that happen to the kids in boarding schools. Sad, sad stories, and sometimes very dark stories.
Mm-hmm.
And I brush against them in the book, but my whole idea is that there are really two sides to the Native experience that we need to address. One is our cultural amnesia, where we don't want to talk about what it is that we did. And the other one, the light side, the bright side, is what these people had to offer in their way of life that we've essentially eradicated from our own history. We have lost things that they possessed that we lose at our own peril. And I wanted the book to present both the dark and the light of what the Native experience
has been. I think you've done that very well.
Well, I worked hard at it. And that was one of the reasons I felt compelled to do this second book, because I wanted to make sure that people didn't, there are two real false directions you can go in dealing with Native reality. And one is to think that everyone is a wise spiritual being and to go seeking Indian wisdom when they're ordinary people like everyone else. And the other one is to be just dripping with guilt at all the things that were done. And there's nothing we can do about the past. We're not, as Dan would say, he doesn't want us to feel guilty. He just wants us to take responsibility. And so I wanted people to know that there is this dark side that we've tended to forget, and yet there is the bright side that we've tended to sort of misinterpret. So that's really what the goal of the book is.
when you look at history, there are so many factors in history that have evolved like this through different parts of the world. Mm-hmm. So I'm so glad that you are helping to, let's say, fill in the blanks where cultural amnesia has not wanted to address. And this is something that you have done quite well. Yellowbird is the name of Dan's sister in the book. Did he actually have a sister, Yellowbird?
Yes. Mm-hmm. That's true. That's accurate.
So this is something, the story as you are relating it is that Dan says to you, you're going to find my sister. Now this is 80 years after the effect. And that is like trying to find a needle in a haystack, and maybe a needle that's the size of a thumbtack.
Mm-hmm.
And you're just going in the story, whoa, how in the world am I going to do it? He said, I don't care, you're just going to do it.
Right. How am I going to do it, and why have you waited this long? And the truth is that I did a big book on Chief Joseph and the Flight of the Nez Perce and did a lot of oral histories. I like oral histories, talking to the elders and incorporating these stories. And one of the stories I heard over and over again is we don't talk about the bad things in the past because it brings them alive again.
Mm-hmm.
They don't have the same time sense we do. The past is as alive to them as the present in many cases. So they didn't. Many times they would run into situations where something bad had happened, and it wasn't repression so much as just a refusal to go back to that place.
Mm-hmm.
And in Dan's case, he hadn't wanted to go back to, they'd waited for his sister to get on the, to come back from the boarding schools one summer. She didn't get off the train, and they never found out what happened to her. He tried to find out because he was the only one in the family that could speak any English because of his time in the boarding schools, but they never were able to find out what happened to her. And he just pushed that away. And then he was pushing 90 at the time I wrote this, and he wanted to know, he said, I need to find out what happened to my sister. I can't live without some resolution. And the reason he came to me is because he figured that Native people are dismissed when they go in asking these questions, and people think, well, they're coming to get a lawsuit, or they're angry. And also, he knew that I'd been to college, and I had degrees, and I was a white man who knew the white man's system. And he thought maybe I could work my way through some of the administrative obfuscation and find the truth of what had happened. But the reality was that we didn't find it through administrative work. We found it through going to the places where
mm-hmm.
these things had happened.
Detective work is fascinating stuff.
Right.
Now,
uh-huh.
you talk about Dan's old dog, Fatback,
mm-hmm.
who is an interesting character in the book. And then you have such other fascinating characters. And you describe in one part of your book, you have a quarter-ton Indian, a gray-bearded white man, a cat-whiskered mechanic named Shitty, and a sweat lodge keeper who talks about personalities of trees. And you're all traveling together.
And we're all traveling together.
All traveling together.
Well, and I will tell you that Fatback was an interesting dog. Fatback actually was in the previous book, Neither Wolf Nor Dog. It was a dog that had come to his house, and he thought his son had been killed in a car accident. That was one of the reasons he contacted me, is his son had been killed in a car accident, and had been about my age, and he'd really wanted his son to do the stories that he had, to tell, to take down his thoughts and stories. But his son had died, and he had kind of assumed, he felt that his son's spirit had moved into the old dog Fatback, an old Labrador. Well, that was all in Neither Wolf Nor Dog, and his initial contact with me at the Wolf for the Wolf at Twilight was that Fatback had died, and I received a note on my windshield in Minnesota saying, Fatback's dead, and I didn't know what it meant, but I called out there to talk to the only man whose phone number I could find, Jumbo. He's like a 400-pound mechanic, and Jumbo said, Dan expects you to come out. So I went out there. Very hesitantly, I didn't know exactly what he wanted, and he said, I want you to bury Fatback. And Fatback had died in January, and this was July. And I said, well, how can I bury her? He said, well, with a shovel. So, well, of course, with a shovel, but where, she's dead, she must be buried. And he said, no, and he nodded over towards the freezer in the corner of his room, and he said, Amana, it's the best you can buy. And sure enough, he had Fatback in a green bag in the Amana freezer. So we went and buried her, and then as we were traveling, he kept looking around. He wanted something, and he came across a little mangy, rotten dog at a little store where we stopped. And he said he wanted that dog, and he made me buy it for $12 from the woman, and he named it Charles Bronson. So he had Charles, and I asked him, well, why did you name it Charles Bronson? And he said, well, I could have named it something else, but I didn't. And so Fatback, and he said that Fatback had sent him a message that Charles Bronson, that he should take Charles Bronson. And he said to me, you know, Charles Bronson came to me, he didn't come to you. And I said, well, that's right. And he said, well, that's because Fatback sent Charles Bronson to me. So he thought Charles Bronson was a message from Fatback. So we were traveling with Fatback, with Grover, and eventually when we ended up at the gravesite where we were looking for his daughter, we had Jumbo and Shitty and his granddaughter Winona were all there. So, yeah, it's an interesting cast of characters. But
it is a very interesting cast of characters.
And, you know, that's the thing that people, that I hope that they get from my work that they are not going to get by most anywhere else they go, is the real fascinating, funny, spiritual, crazy, obscene, nutty lives that Indian people live.
Mm-hmm.
They're just wonderful. The reservation is a wonderful place, even as it's tragic and people die young and there's alcoholism and trash and junk cars. These are amazing people. And I love spending time on the reservations, and I love to bring their stories out because I love these people.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is very evident. That comes through. Now, you also went through a sweat lodge experience, which
mm-hmm.
you go into a lot of detail.
Right.
And that wasn't a particularly happy experience, but it was one that made you aware of some things relative to their culture.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you talk about a wonderful baby girl, and Dan reaches out when this girl child is born, and she's called Tunkashila.
Tunkashila, that means grandfather. That's what they call Dan.
Oh, I beg your pardon. I've got the information wrong. So that's the elder's name.
Tunkashila is grandfather in Lakota, and that's what they, and it's also God. They'll talk about Tunkashila as God. The little girl was actually the child of someone who was someone I met on the reservation. The little girl was kind of sickly. And Dan kept saying, maybe she needs an Indian name. Maybe the problem is that she's, you're trying to raise her as a white person. And in the end, he gives the little girl Yellowbird's name, which is Zinkalazi. And that means Yellowbird. And he bequeathed that name that was his sister's name
mm-hmm.
to this little girl because he thinks that she needs to have an Indian name. And that's the way names are passed on.
There's a statement in your book, and I'm going to quote it directly. Sometimes it's hard to tell if the sickness, and he's referring to someone who wasn't well, is in the body or in the spirit. That's why they should go to the medicine man. White man's medicine is okay for sickness in the body, but it can't do anything about a sick spirit. It's good for curing, but it isn't any good for healing. And those words have such a deep wisdom in them that maybe someone who would be listening to my saying that today would say, well, I don't understand what that means. How would you explain it to them?
I'm speaking a little beyond my own knowledge and capabilities here, but there is a definite belief among Native people that illnesses have origins in the spirit world very often. Some people will think it's just in the spirit of an individual being. Some people think that spirits come into people and that can be sometimes sent as evil spirits. You know, that's very much a much more, much deeper traditional model. But generally, there's a sense that spirits, that illness is of the spirit and it manifests in the body.
Mm-hmm.
So if you are sick, and there are some things that once a sickness takes place, you can maybe heal, you can cure the sickness with Western medicine. You can cure the sickness with antibiotics. You can cure the sickness. You can fix broken bones through surgery and an insertion of screws and so forth. But you're not really healing the person. You're just sort of curing them of their initial illness. But to heal a person is to make them whole. And to make them whole, you have to address the source, the spiritual source of the sickness. And I think that's what Dan meant there.
I had to chuckle when the subject of spam comes up in your book,
mm-hmm.
and it's called The White Man's Pemmican.
And
I said, oh, my goodness. That's a rich one. So those of you listening, The Wolf of Twilight, you'll need to get the book. But I wanted to mention something very powerfully stated in your book, and it's Dan speaking to you, and he says, you need to have, you have to do something to turn your heart towards the Creator. Maybe leave a little bit of food on the plate, like your favorite part. Throw a bite of your food on the earth if you're outside. Maybe say a little prayer before you do something. Just make a little ritual. And you say, aren't the rituals part of the tradition? He says, nah, those are ceremonies. A ritual is just something you do over and over. It's just a way to focus your mind. Now, a ceremony is something you have to do right. It's a way to call to the Creator to pay attention to what you're doing. And he also says you've got to be praying all the time or else you're just thinking about yourself. There is so much of this wisdom, and among the native cultures, there is that honoring the creative principle of life. Some people like to call it God. Some people will label it Buddha or whatever their religious background might be. But the Indians would call it the Creator. And it was very significant to me how you bring out these points and how it was important for him to make you understand that to honor the creative essence of life is part of our responsibility.
Absolutely. And if there's one thing that I've learned, in I look at the gifts that I've been given by Native people or by being around Native people and just seeing the way they live their lives, one of them is this intertwining of the sacred and the ordinary, that we have such a tendency towards spiritual bifurcation in our culture. We either are seeking the spiritual or we're living in the daily affairs, and we have a difficult time weaving the two together. The Native people don't. You can find people who are just rusty and, you know, dirty and obscene. I don't mean dirty in a pornographic sense, but people who are living real low, but they
mm-hmm.
are willing to talk about the spirit or the issues that are spiritual. And as Dan said, one of the things that the Native people do is they have the spirit. They put the words of the spirit on the lips, because what's on the lips makes its way to the heart. And we have a tough time talking about the holy, talking about God, but they have no difficulty talking about the spiritual thing or the great spirit. I mean, like some of us have a difficult time saying a grace before a meal because it seems like we're imposing something on other non-believers. For them, it's simply a matter of the spirit is present everywhere, and it's present in every moment, no matter how elevated or how degraded, and you need to acknowledge it. Like in the book, where the story where he gives me this, we buy some hot dogs, and it turns out that they're almost rotten. And he gets mad at me when I throw it on the ground because he said, you should give thanks. And you should give thanks for everything. You should give thanks for that rotten hot dog, even. And he says, I should look at Charles Bronson, who ran right over and grabbed that piece of hot dog. And he said, look at Charles Bronson's more spiritually attuned than you are because he gives thanks for everything, and you don't.
Mm-hmm.
And just the belief that at every point the slight acknowledgement by a gesture. That was one of the things that was important to him, a gesture of acknowledgement to remind yourself. Sometime your life is going too fast to actually stop and focus on something, but if, for example, you leave a bit of the best bit of food on a plate, always, when you finish eating, that's a reminder to you that you're doing this as a gift to the spirit. And he had any number of situations where he would want me to, he'd remind me that, you know, I'm not present. I'm not slowing down enough to be present to the spirit at all points in life. And I think that's one of the teachings that I so value in just the ordinary everyday affairs of Native people.
Well, as you can tell, this book will have so much to give you, and there is so much more in it. There's a wonderful, wonderful ending to the book about Yellowbird and the history and what happened to her. The little girl that the character Dan, who was real in life, mm-hmm. but who has been put into this wonderful book, The Wolf at Twilight, An Indian Elder's Journey Through the Land of Ghosts and Shadows. Kent, do you have a website that people can go to?
Yes, it's www, obviously, Kent Nerburn, KentNerburn.com.
KentNerburn.com.
And there they can read, there should be several sample chapters from the book and ways to purchase an autographed copy. There, you know, the usual things that websites offer, but I encourage anyone who wants to learn a little more to take a look at that.
Thank you, Kent. I wish you the best this holiday season. Thank you for this wonderful book, and when you come out with your next one, you need to let me know. But meanwhile, for those of you listening, The Wolf at Twilight, Kent Nerburn has been my guest. It's a true story that's costumed ever so lightly in a garment of fiction, but something you will read the truth, and you'll feel it and know it within your very being. Donna Seabold here. We're going on a break. We'll be right back.
Okay, thank you so much.
Are you concerned about nutrition? Do you work hard to eat right, try to feed yourself and your family nutritious food? Well, you'll want to know about glyconutrients. What are they? These are sugars that are present in nature, however, we're not getting them in our food anymore. Scientific study is proving that these sugars are necessary for all cellular and immune system function. Over 20,000 studies are conducted each year on glycoforms alone. These are the sugar protein structure that line each and every cell of the body. 4 out of the last 8 Nobel Prizes in physiology have been awarded for research in the area of cellular communication and how these sugars work in the body. This is Donna Seabold. Every day I bring to you information that will empower and light up your life. I would like to invite you to visit my website, DelphiInternational.com, and find out more about these glyconutrients. That's DelphiInternational.com. Go to my website, go to the left side of the screen, tap on the button that says glyconutrients. MIT's Technology Review, February 2003, states that glycomics is one of the 10 emerging technologies that will change the world. Education is the key to advancement of understanding and making our lives better. Visit my site, DelphiInternational.com. Go to the left side of the screen and tap on the button that says glyconutrients. I know it'll make a difference for you, as it has for me.
Do you want to lose weight? Do you deal with diabetes, high blood pressure, osteoporosis, or chronic pain? Do you want to know one of Dr. Perricone's 7 secrets to beauty, health, and longevity? Do you have 15 minutes a day to look and feel better? Then let me introduce you to TTAP, the workout that works. For the beginner or expert exerciser, learn from physical training specialist Teresa Tapp how, in just 15 minutes a day, you can burn fat and sugar, build strong bones and muscles, and lose inches fast with no equipment or jumping. Visit the TTAP website, TTAP.com, or call 1-800-342-0717 to learn how. That's TTAPP.com. We'll help you lose inches, look good, and feel fabulous at TTAP. 1-800-342-0717.
Hi, this is Donna. And telephone lines are now open if you'd like to call in and let me light up your life with a little bit of intuitive insight. Give me a buzz. Our worldwide toll-free number is 888-815-9756. Now, I want to let you know it's coming on tomorrow. Linda McNabb is going to be my guest. She's going to be talking about her personal journey. It's titled One Again, and then on Friday, we're going to be talking about a real cold case murder that actually was solved by a person that had no information about a particular individual and was able to come up with a solution. Thomas Ray Crowell is going to be my guest. And then next week, we've got a wonderful book, Simply Too Good to Be True, Annette Sinn. And then we're going to be talking about some items for children, Riley the Rhinoceros. Patricia Derrick is going to be with me. And Return from a Comatose Mind, Jason Deverling is going to be my guest. And Jason is an individual who actually went through the experience of being in a coma and is now living a very full, productive life. But his experience is one that's quite unusual. And Cooking with Love, Ruth Milstein, is going to be my guest. And actually, we are just going to be talking food next week quite a bit. And Love Your Body, Love Your Life, Sarah Maria is going to be our guest. So there's so many wonderful people always wanting to be out there and making a difference. And you'll hear me say quite frequently on the show, we all make a difference if we each do what we love the most. And I want to say, if you have a special recipe or a special holiday story that you'd like to share with me, send it to Donna at DelphiInternational.com. That's Donna at Delphi, D-E-L-P-H-I, International.com. And Scott Gross sent me a story that is a true story, and he titled it The Christmas Man. And he said, I'd like to share this one, and I said I would be delighted to share it with my audience. And by the way, if you want to give me a call, 888-815-9756 is the number. This is how his story reads. First, the scene. Christmas Eve at a busy Southwest Airlines gate. The gate agent is suffering from a cold. She's away from her family for the holiday season and feeling as miserable as the weather. This is a story about angels, two of them. One is an angel unaware named Rachel. The other is named McDonald. Now, in the words of Angel Rachel, I looked up and saw the sweetest looking old man standing with a cane. He walked very slowly over to the counter and in the faintest voice told me that he had to go to New Orleans. I tried to explain to him that there were no more flights that night, and that he would have to go in the morning. He looked so confused and very worried. I then asked if he had a reservation, or if he remembered when he was supposed to travel, but he seemed to get more confused with each question. He just kept saying, she said, I have to go to New Orleans. It took a while, but finally I was able to discover that this old man had been dropped off at the curb by his sister-in-law on Christmas Eve, and told to go to New Orleans where he had a family. She had given him some cash and told him to just go inside and buy a ticket. When I asked if he could come back tomorrow, he said that she was gone and that he had no place to stay. He then said bravely that he would wait right here until tomorrow. Naturally, I felt a little ashamed. Here I was feeling sorry for myself about being alone for Christmas, when this angel named Mr. McDonald was sent to me as a reminder of what being alone really meant. It broke my heart to see him standing there. I told him not to worry, that we would get everything straightened out. Cynthia, another agent on duty, helped book him a seat on the earliest flight the next morning. We gave him a senior citizen's fare, which left him a little money, a little extra money for traveling. About this time, he started looking very tired, and I stepped around the counter to ask quietly if he was all right. That's when I noticed that his leg was wrapped in a bandage. He had been standing on it the whole time, holding a plastic bag full of clothes. I called for a wheelchair. When the wheelchair came, we both stepped around to help him in and noticed a small amount of blood on his bandage. I asked how he had hurt his leg, and he explained that he had just had bypass surgery and that an artery had been taken from his leg. Can you imagine? This man had heart surgery and shortly afterwards had been dropped off at a curb to buy a ticket with no reservation to fly to New Orleans alone. I'd never really had a situation like this, and I wasn't sure what I could do. I went back to ask my supervisors, Kathy and Mercedes. When they heard the whole story, I asked if we could find a place for him to stay. They both said, absolutely. The man's name was Mr. McDonald. We gave Mr. McDonald a hotel room for the night and a meal ticket for dinner and breakfast. When I came back out, we got his plastic bag of clothes and came together and gave the nice World Services employee a tip to take him downstairs to wait for the shuttle. I bent down to explain that the hotel, food, and itinerary again while I patted him on the arm. I promised him that everything would be just fine. As he was about to be wheeled away, he said, "Thank you," bent his head, and started to cry. I cried, too. When I went back to thank Kathy, she just smiled and said, "I love stories like that. He is your Christmas man." Merry Christmas to you and yours. I thought the story was so profound, and it makes a statement about how people, individual people, make a big, big difference. And whether it's Christmas or some other time of the year, thoughtfulness, kindness, consideration, and a willingness to listen go a long way in making life a richer experience. And I want to thank you, Scott, for sharing that with me. Well, if you have a comment, a suggestion, or something special about the holidays again, if you would like to get that information to me so I can share it on the air, give me a buzz at 888-815-9756. Now, I've got a recipe for you that I know you're just going to love. That's sweet and sour short ribs. And short ribs are so good. They do take a while to bake, but I'll tell you what, their flavor is out of this world, and they're even better the second day. So this is something you can fix ahead. Sweet and sour short ribs, real easy. So get that pad of paper handy and have it ready. We're going to give the recipe out after the break. But one of the things I wanted to share with you is about a dream castle, and how it saved a soldier's life. Now, this takes place in October of 1918. There was a young Polish woman by the name of Myrna who began harassing local authorities to rescue her fiancé. Stanislaus Omenski was the young man's name, and she said he's trapped in darkness covered with rubble. Now, the soldier, her beloved, had marched off to World War I and vanished during the battle. She began to have dreams, and these dreams were so vivid that she saw her missing soldier love groping desperately by candlelight in a cave-in of rubble and timber. Now, little by little, the dreams started giving her more information. They showed a castle on a hilltop, and one of the castle's towers had crumbled into a heap of stone and wood. She could hear him calling out for help. Well, guess what? They thought she was nuts. Seems to still happen today. She told her mother of the recurring dream, and they went to the village priest. He didn't believe her either. So there was no support for Myrna. So she decided she was going to get results. She started searching the country. She was poor. She didn't have any money. And her area that she lived in was just full of all kinds of derelict castles. And she said, where could he be, to herself? So she wandered the area where someone had said they had seen him last. And she was sleeping at a roadside area, and farmers were giving her food. People were very compassionate that were there. And eventually she found a hilltop overlooking the Sound of Złota. and in the distance was the castle she had seen in her dreams. Now, when she saw it, she ran into the local village. She collapsed. She was totally exhausted. She was found in the square, and there was a fountain in the square. That's where she had collapsed. The villagers gathered around her. She told the story, and although the people didn't want to believe her, they followed her to the castle, and they saw her determination to dig, and they began to help her. After 2 days of prying away massive boulders and timber, an opening was discovered. They could hear a voice calling. The village men went into the tunnel and emerged with this very, very weak soldier, Stanislaus. He had been in the old castle when the tower had been struck by an artillery shell, sealing him inside. The wonderful ending to this story, which is a true one, is that this wonderful couple, Myrna and Stanislaus, were married. Dreams? Can they tell something? Absolutely. Donna Sebo here. We're taking a break. We're going to be back in a moment. Give me a call, 888-815-9756. And I'll light up your life with a little bit of insight.
If you're searching for the perfect gift for a child, consider God's Kiss by Donna Sebo. That's right. Donna is not only a mental practitioner and psychic, she's an author as well. God's Kiss beckons all children and the young at heart to enter the dream world of a little traveler named Johnny. You can order your book today by sending a check or money order to Mrs. Sebo's Classics, Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. That's Post Office Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497. If you'd like both the book and cassette, you pay only $19.95 plus applicable tax and shipping charges. This is the book for your favorite child of any age. Donna Sebo's God's Kiss is about a child's sense of place in the world, and it's destined to be a children's classic. Order now. Call 1-800-872-8852. That's 1-800-872-8852. God's Kiss is written by Donna Sebo and illustrated by Ed Gedrose. Buy it today. 1-800-872-8852.
Donna Sebo publishes a popular, inspirational, and insightful newsletter filled with information about her upcoming guests, her travel schedule, seminar presentations, and upbeat articles to lighten up your life. You can subscribe to this free monthly newsletter by emailing her at donna@delphiinternational.com. That's donna@delphiinternational.com. You can also go to her website, www.delphiinternational.com, and review past publications. Keep in touch with Donna through this monthly publication. Again, her email address is donna@delphiinternational.com, and her website is www.delphiinternational.com.
And if you want to give me a buzz, call me at 888-815-9756. Okay, here's the recipe for sweet and sour short ribs. But before I do that, I want to share a little quote that someone made that says, "The wife who drives from the back seat isn't any worse than the husband who cooks from the dining room table." Just a little bit of silliness there. Okay, sweet and sour short ribs. Oh, we've got a caller. Well, I'm going to have to hold off on the recipe, but keep that pad of paper and pen handy. Let's go to the caller. First name or initial, and where are you calling from?
Initial D from Everett.
Hi, this is Donna.
Hi.
And I'm so glad that you're on the air with me here. Now, Dee, did you have a special question for me today? Because I know you called in not too long ago.
No, I don't have any. Just just wondering if you can tell me what you see.
Okay. The first thing I am looking at is that there is an unexpected trip that's going to be coming up for you. And this is going to be a short trip, and I think it is going to be relating to an aspect of business. But I would like to encourage you, when you do take the trip, because you seem to be a little stressed over it, that you take a day or two extra to add on just for some pleasure, because I think you need to have a break of some type. And I'm looking at you with interest because there seems to be something from your past that you have closed a door on, and I don't know if it's a particular relationship, I don't know if it is a particular lifestyle, I haven't a clue at this moment, but I do know that it's very important for you to realize that there is something from your past that you think you have released, and it's sort of like a habit patterning, I think, really. And you need to make it okay to move forward into a new direction for yourself so that you can learn to enjoy life and take what I'd call little sabbaticals, little breaks every once in a while. Maybe becoming involved in something that has an artistic flavor to it, or maybe you decide you're going to go in for kite flying. I don't know. It needs to be something that's fun. It could be ballroom dancing. Anything that is going to offer you an opportunity to physically do something that is so opposite from the intellectual side of the self. If you do that, then you're going to find that there's going to be a lot more joy in your life, and you're actually going to find an extending of what I call a social circle around you that is going to be just delightful. You are going to be at a crossroads regarding a decision around the 18th of February. What this decision is at this time, I'm not being shown. But I'm seeing you at the crossroads, and you're going to be able to make a decision within 2 days after this challenge or opportunity, whatever cloak it might be wearing, will come to your attention. The decision will have to be made fairly quickly, but if you will use the information at hand, ask the right questions, your decision will not be hard for you to make, and that is going to break what I consider the glass ceiling for you that maybe you have felt you've been experiencing on a professional and a personal level.
February 18th?
Mm-hmm. Something's happening around that time frame.
Okay, so around February. So do you think that I should go for it if there's something coming, or should I not go for it?
You need to evaluate the information and not respond emotionally. You need to look at it with clarity, assess the information, and then make your choice.
Okay.
And I want to wish you a happy holiday season.
And then, can I ask something quick? You said that there's a quick business trip coming up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Oh, I don't see it because it's very close to the holiday. I'm not sure how that's going to happen.
Well, this is something very quickly. Don't worry about it. It's not going to take a whole bunch of time. The only thing I would say is if you could tack on whenever this comes up in the near future, it could be within the next month. So whatever you do, just relax about it. If you can take an extra day, wherever you will be going, it is considered business by you. And it may have something to do with work. It could be personal business. But if you can, tack on an extra day so you can just play.
Okay. Okay, great.
Happy holidays to you. You are very welcome,
Dee.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This is Donna Sebo, and I'll give you this sweet and sour rib recipe rather quickly. So if you've got that my mouth isn't wanting to work there. Pad of paper and a pen, here we go. You're going to need about 3 pounds of short ribs. And what you want to do, you want to roast them. Now, you're going to need a 350-degree oven. You're going to be roasting the ribs for 1.25 to 1.5 hours. So, because they've got a little bit of fat in them, you're going to want to really get them tender. Now, you baste them with soy sauce, you know, just before you put them in the oven, and then you just let them roast. Now, this is the sauce that goes with the ribs that are that's absolutely delicious. You're going to need a cup of sugar, a cup of vinegar, and that should be white vinegar, a half a cup of sherry wine, 2 tablespoons of soy sauce, 1 green pepper sliced. You need 1 tablespoon of cornstarch, 1 tablespoon of sugared ginger, 1/2 cup of pineapple chunks, 1/4 cup of sweet pickles. Now, the first 5 ingredients, the sugar, the vinegar, the sherry wine, the soy sauce, and the green pepper, you bring it to a boil in a medium saucepan. Add the cornstarch that's been mixed with water and dissolved. You stir it until it's clear and thick. Then you add your finely cut candied ginger, pineapple chunks, and sweet pickles. And after your ribs are cooked, you drain off the fat, I used to cook them on a rack. And you continue to bake for an additional 20 minutes, basting it with this sauce. Yum, yum. A little baked potato or rice or whatever you like with a nice green salad. You've got a wonderful dinner there. Well, we're out of time. Remember always, you're the master of your fate. You are the captain of your soul. You are the person that's going to be able to make your life a testimonial of greatness by just being true to yourself. This is Donna Sebo. Talk with you tomorrow, same time, same place, right here on bbsradio.com. Bye for now.
You have been listening to The Donna Sebo Show. If you would like a copy of today's broadcast, send $10 to The Donna Sebo Show, P.O. Box 97272, Tacoma, Washington, 98497-0272. Be sure to put the date of the broadcast in your request. If you are not able to be a part of today's program, join Donna and her guests Monday through Friday, and she will be here to take your calls. Thank you for listening and being part of our program. Have a wonderful day.